You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Words like materialism, consumerism, and commodification have been so overused that they've lost most of their power. Howard Bloom argues that we've made a mistake in stigmatizing and dehumanizing them, and that this current economic crisis may be a good time to take a fresh look at Western civilization and the nature of capitalism. He is the founder of three international groups and the Howard Bloom Organization, the largest public relations firm in the record industry. His latest work, published by Prometheus Books, is called The Genius of the Beast, A Radical Revision of Capitalism, and I'm very pleased that it brings Howard Bloom to our show today. Hi.
Thanks, Leonard.
Since this is a book about rethinking capitalism, why have you gone all the way back to bacteria as a starting point rather than the Industrial Revolution?
Well, because capitalism is a cosmos that has metabolisms. This is a cosmos that's had metabolisms since stars came into existence 300,000 to a million years after the Big Bang. And we tend to think of capitalism, and we tend to think of getting and spending, what Wordsworth called getting and spending, as unnatural and as only a result of the Industrial Revolution. And we tend to denigrate some of the things that we do that shouldn't be denigrated in the least. And one of those things that we denigrate is consumerism and materialism, too. My arithmetic was off. And consumerism, materialism are basic to the cosmos. This is a very spendthrift cosmos, a very materialist cosmos. When the cosmos put together the first quarks during the first 10 to the minus 32nd of the universe, she only produced 16 different kinds, but she produced gazillions of them. When those quarks came together in threes, some of those threes made protons, some made neutrons. Already the cosmos was showing her obliviousness to the catastrophe of death. Because you could say, what are you talking about? We've only got neutrons and protons here. Any neutron that didn't gather together in a social group by the time it was 10.6 minutes old was a goner. It was it. It dissolved. It died.
And forever.
Yeah, it died forever. And that kind of thing has been going on in this cosmos for a very long time. Once stars did evolve, stars and galaxies evolved by the hundreds of billions is not an adequate figure for them. And nature was so callous about disposing of material things and creating waste and using waste creatively that she let her first generation of stars die. And in the process of even the life of those stars was an ignition that tore apart the hearts of atoms. And their screams, in a sense, were the first photons, the first light.
How does this connect to Western civilization?
Well, that's a very good question, because Western civilization and civilization in general has something that we don't take into account, and it's something that can't be explained by quarks and protons and neutrons. We think of, Marx said that all capital is stored labor, that the only thing of value, in fact, in any kind of an economy, is the storage of muscle labor, sweat labor. And Marx was overlooking the fact that capital is really something very different. Yes, it's material goods and tools of production and money, but even more than that, it's stored spirit, it's stored stored inspiration, it is stored persistence, and it's stored persuasion. Because if you have a crazy idea, if you're Steve Jobs in 1970 and you've just taken on your first computer job and you have wild ideas that could lead to an iPod, it's going to take you 40 years of persistence before you finally get to an iPad. It's going to take you 40 years of sticking to it when everybody says you are crazy, you are absolutely nuts. And it's that stored passion and stored vision that goes into what we call capital.
And then the question is whether we need an iPad or not.
Well, we certainly do, because what happens, I remember the cosmos...
You need it, I don't need an iPad.
Oh, I need it lustily. I have techno-lust to the nth degree. But... What we're involved here in is a cosmos that defies entropy, just shreds entropy. The cosmos is constantly moving up one notch after another in radically unexpected ways. Who could predict from quarks that there would be neutrons and protons, and from those that there would be stars and galaxies?
Although entropy is the future, isn't it?
Oh, no. Entropy is a big mistake. Remember, I started out in theoretical physics at the age of 10, so I've been hanging around entropy most of my life. And entropy is one of the biggest mistaken notions we've ever seen, because the cosmos has never fallen down. She's always fallen up. She never falls apart. She falls together.
And now she's speeding up, even though nobody understood how that would work.
You've got it. And that's where spirit and imagination come in. Now, nature has been fast in her creative processes before. The number of things that happened in the first 10^-30 seconds of the universe, the number of breakthroughs and innovations, was absolutely staggering. But she slowed down once she got past that initial period of instant creativity. And now she's regaining her instant creativity through you and me.
So if capitalism is something that is quite natural, then why is it, why wasn't it something that developed universally?
Well, economies, as the metabolism of societies, have developed universally. Some economies have accomplished a lot more than others. We're the only economy that's produced the iPad. Capitalism is based on universal principles, but it's not the only form of social organization by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, there's an imperative hidden in capitalism that very few of the capitalists that I have ever worked with seem to see, and it is: be messianic. Save thy neighbor. You only get paid. You only make money to the extent that you give something of value to your fellow human beings that does something of substance for their lives. And since you depend on other human beings to pay you, ultimately, not on stockholders, not on cutting costs, but the people who pay you for your goods and services, you owe them the best service you can possibly give.
Well, that's one way of looking at capitalism. The way I remember learning about it in school, from a non-Marxist teacher, because it was during the Cold War and nobody would admit to being a Marxist teacher, was that capitalism developed out of certain people developing companies to the detriment of all the people who worked for them. And they made the less they paid, the more hours they could get out of them, the more successful they were. And that was the basis of capitalism.
There is some truth to that, but not entirely. It's not entirely true. There are some people who must have perceived it that way. Frankly, I've read most about it in Marx, about people who perceived it that way.
Although many people say Marx is probably the greatest writer on capitalism. They may not appreciate Marxism, but he pretty well understood capitalism.
Well, he made a lot of mistakes. From 1800 to 1900, the century of the Industrial Revolution, in America, actually from 1776 until 1900, the productivity of the economy went up by a factor of 175. The productivity, or the wages of the average worker, tripled. Now, you can say, God, there's some horrible inequality here. We went up by a factor of 175, but workers' wages only went up by a factor of 3. And there is inequality that we could look at. But the fact is, for workers' wages to triple in a century, nothing like that had ever happened in such a short amount of time, save in the days of imperialism. And I mean things like Roman imperialism and Islamic imperialism after 630 AD, because then if you managed to knock off another bunch of states in a small amount of time, the booty came flowing in.
Is there a uniquely American version of Western civilization?
Yes, I think there is. And somebody like James Fallows from The Atlantic has commented in his books over and over again that this is really the only mongrel civilization. This is really the only civilization that is constantly fed by a stream of newcomers. This is the only one. Japan is not tolerant of racial minorities or ethnic minorities. China is not tolerant of ethnic minorities and racial minorities. Far from it. But we live on ethnic minorities and racial minorities, so that makes us radically different.
Although we've always had our problems dealing with that, and other countries like France have also lived on ethnic minorities and had their problems with
But France doesn't. France is very much about being French. And we are not, you know, they have the largest Muslim.
You haven't been to a Tea Party rally recently.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to say Americans aren't all about being Americans.
No, I loathe the anti-immigrant movements. They're absolutely despicable. And there are lots of things about America or any other country you could choose, no matter how idealistic its system, that are absolutely despicable. But why are you and I here? We're here in part to see what the positives are so we don't destroy them, and what the negatives are so that we can ameliorate them and uplift the society in general.
My guest is Howard Bloom, whose book, The Genius of the Beast, A Radical Revision of Capitalism, is published by Prometheus Books. What part of the conventional story behind Western civilization do you find misleading, or most misleading?
Henry Ford went out of his way to raise the wage of his workers to $5 a day, and he did it out of thinking this was the fair and right thing to do. Now, eventually, when unions moved in, Henry Ford didn't like losing his paternal control over his workers, and he had his men fight the unions with guns. There's a positive there, and there's a negative there. Plus, Henry Ford is an anti-Semite, and I was a Jew, and Henry Ford's book was used by Adolf Hitler to wipe out a bunch of us. So there are lots of negatives to look at. But I think that what we misunderstand is the incredible extent to which our lives have been changed by technology, and this has been the leading technological civilization.
Well, many people will tell you that capitalism these days has become a system for applying financial tricks.
And in this country,
we are seeing less innovation than we did in the past. And as we become more of a service economy, an economy based on the financial system, we put out, make ourselves vulnerable to the kind of situation we're in right now.
It's a very good point, but a couple of things. First of all, looking only at the financial sector and Wall Street, you're not really looking at capitalism. These are people who are riding the past achievements of our civilization, not producing the achievements of the next 30 years. And it's the people of the next, the people who achieve the, who produce the achievements, the creative achievements of the next 30 years. Again, the Steve Jobs, because he's the leading example of this decade. Those are the people who are going to lead us to the promised land and keep us from being totally inundated by the Chinese. If we are, God forbid, left in the hands of the people in Wall Street and the money manipulators, we will be in very, very serious trouble.
A listener wants to know what you think of Ayn Rand.
I loathe her, and I loathe, and you know, I know that's going to turn off a lot of people, even who love my books, but I do loathe her, and I loathe her because of her concept that sheer raw selfishness is the way to go, and that there's something idealistic, noble, and proud about being nothing but raw selfishness.
So what economists do you admire?
I don't think I admire any of the economists. The people that I read tend to be E.O. Wilson on sociobiology, and Robin Fox and Lionel Tiger a long, long time ago in their book on the imperial animal. I think that the people and evolutionary biologists and cosmologists.
Although you write in your book that you were once sold on the ideas of Nikolai Kondratiev.
Oh, yes. Well,
he was a Soviet economist.
He was a Soviet economist who came up with an economic theory that was harmless as far as we could see, but not so far as Stalin could see, because Stalin put him to death over the economic theory. And Kondratiev, you're right, Kondratiev had a very compelling, made a very compelling case. First of all, a fact. This is not Kondratiev's theory. This is a fact. Recessions come every 4.5 years on the average. It's a figure that wobbles. And Great Depressions, like the one that we're in now, come every 67.5 years, again, on average, and it wobbles back and forth. So it's hard to say that that we can blame this particular crash on bankers or on faulty theories or anything else, because these crashes come in cyclical patterns no matter what we do. But Nikolai Kondratiev had the theory that we have these things he called super cycles, the Kondratiev wave, and that they do happen approximately every 70 years. And they happen because we develop a new technology, the way the British developed the steam engine at around 1800. And then there's a demand for that technology that builds. And then if we're the British and we're selling steam engines and selling the cloth that's made by steam engines operating power looms, we're going to experience explosive growth for 20 to 30 years while that new technology kicks in. But then the technology is going to peak, and everybody who's got a steam-powered locomotive is not only going to have one, but they're going to figure out how to make one in their own country. Everybody who's buying cotton shirts and baseball caps, or at that point, railroading caps, is going to have one or is going to be capable of making it in their own country. And then an economy like that of England's will begin to peak, and eventually, as the technology declines, England will decline. Well, the fact is that technology declines do not account for all great depressions. 1929 to 1939 was definitely a significant depression, but the technologies in 1929 were just on their upwards curve. They were just beginning. The automobile was one of those technologies. The radio was another one of those technologies. A wild and wacky idea called electrifying every single home was a coming technology. And the indoor heater, the central heating unit, was a coming technology.
And we had this recent crash at the same time that the iPod is being introduced. So obviously there are other factors. There are other reasons that England went into decline that have nothing to do with the steam engine.
Right.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with more of my conversation with Howard Bloom, his book, The Genius of the Beast, a radical revision of capitalism, published by Prometheus Books. We're back with Howard Bloom, who is a scientific theorist, among other things. His latest book is called The Genius of the Beast, a radical revision of capitalism. It's published by Prometheus. A listener says, you know, slavery was very American. How does that fit in with your idea that capitalism is messianic?
We have in the capitalist system and in Western civilization in general something called a protest industry, and it started around slavery. It started in roughly 1760 to 1780, and it took advantage of the same tools of mass production that the Industrial Revolution did. It took advantage of the printing press. It took advantage of the fact that eventually that printing press was driven by steam engines and all the other media miracles that have happened in the last 230 years. And yes, capitalism was part of the pre-industrial American civilization, and it hung in for a long time. But boy, have we, the British purged it first. They got rid of it in 1808. It took us a long time after that to get rid of it. But we have really thwunked it out of our system. Look at our current president.
It's interesting that at the time slavery was in place, much of the industry in this country was in the Northeast. After the South lost the Civil War, so much of that industry, all of those textile mills moved to the South. Maybe the South did win that war. Another listener says, well, if Steve Jobs is leading us to the promised land from the Chinese, where are all those iPads and iPods being built? What about that side of capitalism?
They are being built by the Chinese. And one of the strange, look, back in the 1960s and the 1970s, when you and I were young idealists, one of the things that we kept demanding of our civilization was that it uplift the downtrodden countries of the world, that it uplift the undeveloped powers. Well, those undeveloped powers have uplifted themselves. They've done it by aping Western techniques, not only Western technologies, but even the Western, certain aspects of the Western capitalist system, minus the protest industry, which is a very important part of the Western system. But the fact is, now that they are getting to their feet, that means money is sloughing off of us and moving in their direction. And we are now wildly upset about that, and we call it globalization. 40 years ago, we would have regarded it as our dreams of social justice coming true.
How would you explain the recent financial meltdown? I get the feeling from the book that you don't think that greed, bad fiscal policies, the decline in financial regulation have played much of a role in it.
I don't think they played a significant role at all. What they have done is, okay, it's a basic biological pattern. This is a pattern of it's a pattern of exploration. Let's spread out and explore things. Let's be ebullient about things. Let's go into things that people would say we're crazy for going into and try out our fantasies. That's the period of economic good times. That's when we're all investing in strange things and the imaginary idea that we'll get rich overnight.
Although people were being screwed during that time, as it turns out.
But Leonard, let's differentiate between the cycle and the sins. The sins of capitalism are there, just as the sins of communism were there in Russia. And it is our job to spot them and stop them.
Well, but if you're going to just see this as a cyclical thing, well, this is not a typical four-year cycle. This is more like 1929 revisited.
That's right.
The president is saying that if he didn't come up with this bailout package, we would have had another Great Depression.
And that's because this is the next 67.5-year cycle, just as the Great Depression of 1873 to 1890 was the Great Depression of its time.
Do you think that the bank bailout and the economic stimulus package were good ideas?
I think that the bank bailout was an absolute necessity, because what we've been forgetting in all of the commentary this year on the bank bailouts is that the real depression of 1929 to 1939 did not happen in 1929. Yes, in 1929 there was Black Tuesday, and in 1929 the stock market crashed and things looked very bad, but they began to look up again. It was in 1931 when an obscure bank in Austria called Creditanstalt collapsed, that there was a domino effect that went all the way around the world. And that's what really caused the misery of the Great Depression.
Now, you compared the sins of capitalism with the sins of communism, but communism, for all intents and purposes, is no longer with us. And there are people who are saying that capitalism, as we've known it, will no longer be with us. We have to come up with some kind of a reform system.
Well, I wrote this book because in 2001, when the World Trade Center went down, friends of mine started coming over. I was stuck in bed for 15 years, so I had to have my guests at my home, and friends were coming to my home and saying, Western civilization is about to die, and guess what? It deserves to die. It's the worst civilization in the history of mankind. And I knew for one thing, Leonard, that people like you and me could not exist in another civilization. We could not exist in the Chinese civilization. We could not have existed in the Russian civilization. Look what happened to poor Nikolai Kondratiev, simply because he came up with an interesting and very intriguing theory. He was killed by Stalin. And
I've always wondered what it would have been like to have been an Incan or a Mayan.
It would have been rather ghastly because those were very, very bloody societies, and they were very highly disciplined societies. And, you know, 8,000 people a day killed on the steps of the pyramids in the capital city of the Aztec civilization.
At least that's Mel Gibson's version.
Yeah. But it's also the version of a lot of historians. That would have been a bloody fate. This civilization has allowed something that no other civilization has allowed, and that is a freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of creativity that has never existed in any previous civilization.
Now, you talked earlier about your background in science, and this you've published articles on subjects as varied as quantum physics, cosmology, neurobiology. But your name is on a PR firm. And you've been connected to the music industry. I'm not sure I can understand how I can put all that together.
Well, I started in science at the age of 10 in microbiology and theoretical physics, primarily cosmology. And then 3 years later, I had spent a quarter of my life in science, as strange as that sounds. I was 13, and when the bar mitzvah checks were all cashed and the presents all opened, I allowed myself to realize something very basic. I was an atheist. And everybody that I knew, my parents, who tried to drag me to high holiday services with me holding onto the car door and refusing to go, my parents and every tribe I'd ever read about, I'd run a considerable amount of anthropology by that time, believed in gods. And that meant, and the first two rules of science, as I'd learned them at the age of 10, were the truth at any price, including the price of your life, and look at things run under your nose as if you've never seen them before. Look at things that you and everybody else around you take for granted as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And I suddenly realized, if there are gods in the beliefs of just about every human on this planet, and there are no gods in the sky, then they've got to be in the human soul and the human mind. And it became my job to find the gods inside. And I wasn't going to find them by going to grad school in clinical psychology with any of my fellowships. I was going to have to go into some place where the gods really come alive in the lives of human beings, where ecstatic experiences really do happen. And it turned out...
You found it in capitalism?
Well, I found it by going into something I didn't know anything about. I was a Rachmaninoff, Beethoven, and Bartok listener. And I ended up in the rock and roll business, and it turned out to be the land where the gods come alive. And you know that because you used to do a gospel show, and I worked with Shirley Caesar and the Mighty Clouds of Joy. And I was there at Columbia University when the Mighty Clouds of Joy were playing one day, and women started getting up in the audience and breaking out in what looked like epileptic fits. Those were the gods coming to life inside of them.
Jellagon is a god? Oh, well. Howard Bloom, his book is called The Genius of the Beast, A Radical Revision of Capitalism. It's published by Prometheus Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A caller wants to know if it's the natural state of capitalism that the top 1% get rich while others live in poverty.
Well, I can't say whether it's the natural state of capitalism because there is no natural state of capitalism. It evolves in part by engaging people like you and me to be active within it. And so far as I have my say, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's these gross distortions of wealth and $60 million bonus packages, which is enough money to buy a town. All the real estate, all the stores in a town. This is grotesque, and it has to stop.
Well, I guess this has led other listeners to come up with similar objections. One wants to know how your theories compare to the horrors of the Industrial Revolution, the triangle shirtwaist fire, the child labor, low wages.
Well, there's no justification for those, and they're all cited in my book. But on the other hand, if you go back and you—and this is going to sound terrible, I'll be crucified by the listeners, and that is that if you go back and read a document that Alexander Hamilton put together in between 1780 and 1792, it was a document recommending that America copy something that England was just beginning to get involved with industrializing. And it said, look at the benefits. If we have a machine that'll do the work of 12 human beings, do you know what we can do? You know those wives and children on farms stuck out in the middle of the wilderness in the gray and darkness of the winter, and they have nothing to do and it drives them crazy? Even those kids can work and bring home extra money. So child labor at one point looked utopian.
Somebody else asked, isn't consumerism you're in support of responsible for the wealth gap that you detest?
Not at all. To the contrary. My grandparents were poor. And I've walked into this, you can see me here in this studio, with my Kindle, with my my recording device from Japan, with just surrounded by a sheath of electronic equipment. Once upon a time, when I was young and you were young, I used to walk from one location to another in silence. And all that took place in my brain was aching and pain and the squabbles with people that I knew. It was wretched. Now I take in information 24 hours a day. Has my life been impoverished or enriched? It's been enriched.
Some people might say impoverished because you stopped just having those kinds of thoughts that sometimes can enrich our lives.
But I've discovered
those private thoughts.
I've discovered that the more information you take in from outside, the more private thoughts you have.
A listener from Queens, Stephen, writes, capitalism and access to the Internet are spreading in China, and yet we don't see any growth in liberal democracy, as many did predict. Rather, the opposite. We're seeing nationalism, xenophobia. Lawyers are being thrown into jail for defending people's rights. Why is that?
Because we have a bunch of tools that are morally indifferent, and they can be used for good or they can be used for evil. One of the primary examples is something that was invented 2.5 million years ago, the hammer. It can be used to build a house or it could be used to kill. And the same applies to money. The same applies to the Internet. Once upon a time, the same applied to the printing press. In the West, we think the printing press automatically created liberties. It didn't. In the West, it was used to enrich our variety of ideas, our range of choices. But in Russia, it was used for exactly the opposite. The only person allowed to have a printing press was the Tsar, and the Tsar issued his ukases, his edicts, and used the printing press to print up hundreds of thousands of them so everybody could be told exactly what to do and when to do it.
We could say the same thing about films, which have been seen as a democratizing art and also were used by the Nazis to make films like Jude Sus, I guess
right.
It is, and the Triumph of the Will, etc., propaganda films that motivated people to do awful things.
Right, which means that the listener who's asked that question, it's his responsibility, your responsibility, and my responsibility to make sure that these things are used in the richest way possible.
How is mass behavior in humans the same as the mass behavior in other animals, something that you write about here?
Well, first of all, let's go back to the quarks. Mass behavior goes back a long, long way in this cosmos. We talked about the fact that there were only 16 different forms of quarks, but there were gazillions of identical copies of each. And those quarks came with social rules built into them. That is, they had rules of who they should gang up with and who they should avoid. Those are the rules of attraction or repulsion. And as I said before, they had an absolute imperative to gang up in groups of three. So, I've lost track of the question, Leonard.
It was about mass behavior in humans and mass behavior in other animals.
Right. So mass behavior goes all the way back to the beginning of the cosmos. But we can see an awful lot more of the emergent properties of mass. First of all, this property of my friend Valerius Geist is the head of one of the major wildlife organizations in Canada, and he's one of the world's leading experts on big game behavior. And when he wrote a book on evolutionary biology, he said that all animal communication boils down to attraction and repulsion. And we can see that all the way from quarks to us human beings.
Do you see capitalism as having the same moral underpinnings as religious faiths and philosophies?
No, because it's not a faith. It's something that grows, and we don't know quite how it grows, and no definition that we've been able to come up with adequately captures it.
Well, should we be held responsible for the damage that we've done to the environment?
Yes, we should be held responsible for any damage that we've done. Criminal behavior within the capitalist system is criminal behavior.
But you seem to feel that we really aren't causing this climate change that most scientists think we are.
I'm very skeptical about it. I've been skeptical about it from the beginning, but I could be wrong. I'm supposed to give a lecture to an organization of National Garden store owners in the summer, and I've been told by the head of this National Garden Store Association that the maps have had to be changed for all of the stores about which climatic ranges you can plant which plants in. And to his mind, the warming is definitely happening. You know, it's true that there were 20 global warmings during the 2 million years in which we evolved as human beings, and that most of those
usually caused by cataclysms, asteroids hitting
Earth.
Yes,
exactly. And there are
and
other
things.
And
now we're doing it ourselves.
Well, maybe we're doing it ourselves, but one thing we have to recognize is whether we're doing it ourselves or not, this has been an earth of massive global catastrophe caused by weather changes. And look at all the 60 ice ages we lived through while becoming human. So the one thing we know is this little 12,000-year period of good weather that we've had is an anomaly. It's unlike anything that usually happens on this earth, and it's due to end one way or the other.
One other thing. You describe humans as the sensory cells on the fingertips of the universe. What do
yes.
you mean by that?
I mean that you and I are made of protons that are 13.73 billion years old, and we're the most ambitious form of public works project that protons have ever conceived. And when we dream, when we imagine, when we let our conscience rule and try to figure out what is moral and what is not, we are nature's way of developing a consciousness and an imagination.
It's obvious you haven't seen Avatar.
I haven't seen Avatar.
Howard Bloom's latest book is called The Genius of the Beast, A Radical Revision of Capitalism. It's published by Prometheus Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Leonard, you've been a pleasure.